Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to another edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. India's relationship with the United States seems to be going from bad to worse. U.S. business groups are lobbying for strong action against India, which they say is a serious violator of intellectual property rights. On the top of the bitter diplomatic row over the arrest over an Indian diplomat last year, it risks to further deteriorate in bilateral ties. For more, here's Karen Snowden.
Some U.S. business groups are very unhappy with India. Their anger is often directed at India's generic drug industry, which provides affordable medicines outside of patents. They say India is one of the worst offenders for pirated software. Its domestic content rules for the solar industry and its steel exports threaten U.S. jobs. U.S. manufacturers want India designated as a priority foreign country, and that could lead to trade sanctions. Dr. Amit Tendu Palat, visiting senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore, says India has been on the watch list for some time and won't be worried.
In fact, you would find not only India there, but also China and a country like Thailand and several other countries on that.
Shekhar Gupta, editor-in-chief of the Indian Express newspaper, says India's growing export clout is the reason for US disquiet.
Because when the relationship was much smaller, these things did not matter that much. Or when the relationship was more one-sided, these things did not matter. But India is now a sizable exporter of skilled services or of value-added products. So there are tensions.
It's unlikely the issues of trade will be sorted out anytime soon. Amit Tendu Palat says India won't back down and disagreements will be a feature of the relationship.
Some of these are going to be very difficult to wash under the carpet. And I think an issue like the intellectual property, on which there has been long differences between India and the US, is going to remain there for a considerable period of time.
Even with the signing of the historic nuclear accord in 2006, U.S. industry was unhappy over the restrictions against it. They also don't agree on climate change, but dire predictions that the important strategic partnership between Washington and New Delhi are shaky are probably exaggerated. Amit Tendu Palat says the relationship will withstand the stresses.
So when we look at a larger geopolitical spectrum, I think both India and US will obviously take note of the fact that this is a relationship which is very important not only for the two of them, but also for the greater stability of the region and the rest of the world. So to that extent, they will obviously work on ensuring that their relationship does not, under any circumstances, dip to a point where it creates greater instability or brings in a sense of disharmony that kind of upsets the geopolitical equilibrium. But at the same time, I think now it's pretty clear, at least as far as India is concerned, there are certain areas where India is not willing to budge as easily as it might have done in the past.
As to the latest trade dispute and the possibility of India being listed as the worst of intellectual property offenders, Shekhar Gupta thinks there's a lot of hot air around the issue.
I think some of what's happening in Washington also is posturing. It's posturing also for the sake of their own domestic industry, their pressure groups there. So I think this will be resolved through negotiations. I think Indian companies are very strong now. So they also have strong lobbying power in New Delhi. So this is lobbying power versus lobbying power.
That was Karen Snowden reporting. China is on a propaganda offensive that may strengthen anti-Japanese sentiments domestically. Beijing is considering to add two new national holidays, one to mark Japan's defeat in the Second World War and another to commemorate the Nanjing Massacre. For more, here's Kandahar Sabapati.
If the draft laws now before China's National People's Congress are passed, September 3rd and December 13th will become public holidays. September 3rd marks the anniversary of the formal surrender by Japan, ending the Second World War in 1945. And December 13th commemorates the Nanjing Massacre of 1937, in which some 300,000 civilians were killed following its occupation by Japanese troops. In 1995, then Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama made a formal apology for Tokyo's war atrocities. But as Professor Kerry Brown, director of the China Studies Center at the University of Sydney, says, conservatives in Japan have undercut that by contradictory comments.
very right-wing politicians in Japan have been saying some fairly inflammatory things about the Nanjing massacre didn't happen and that comfort women didn't really exist. And so a lot of irritation. So I think this is a way of striking back.
Masaki Gabe, Professor of International Relations at Ryoko University in Okinawa, says Japan's current Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has made the situation worse by trying to revise the pacifist constitution, rewriting history, and visiting the controversial Yasukuni Shrine.
The LDP member changed the attitude toward, you know, the history under Abe's administration. Abe get also the control of the two chambers, you know, upper and lower house. So Abe has grown confident to do what he wanted.
Professor Gabe, however, believes more than half of Japan's population is not comfortable with Mr. Abe's nationalist attitude.
Because from the national interest viewpoint, his attitude orientates, you know, the Korean relations and also the Chinese relations.
China's irritation with Japan has been further aggravated by the territorial dispute over the Diaoyu Islands, known in Tokyo as the Senkaku Islands, in the East China Sea. Beijing's growing territorial aggressiveness in the East and South China Seas has seen many countries, including Vietnam and the Philippines, joining forces with Japan to stand up against China. So is China using this propaganda offensive against Japan to divert debate about its assertiveness in the region? Professor Brown.
Beijing feels that it's got a legitimate right to speak in a certain way, that it needs its status to be recognized, and that it shouldn't be in this subordinate position a lot of the time. So I think this is driving a lot of its diplomatic behavior at the moment, this idea that this is China's moment, it's a more powerful economy, and why should it always be diplomatically so, you know, humble? It needs strategic space and it shouldn't need to back down.
Next month, President Xi Jinping will visit Germany, and it's believed he would use the opportunity to highlight the contrition that Germany has shown for its war atrocities, unlike Japan. But Professor Brown says Germany will not welcome this.
Because the parallel between China and Japan's conflict in the Second World War and the Holocaust is one that's very, very unpleasant for Germany to think about, and they feel it's sort of like really abusing their history by trying to draw these kind of parallels.
Both China and Japan are trying to personify the other as an aggressor. While such expressions of nationalist sentiments would not augur well for international relations, Professor Brown says it will pay dividends to both Mr. Abe and Mr. Xi in the domestic arena.
They're in a position where if they back down, then they'll be accused of being weak by constituencies. They're both relatively new leaders. So I think there's good returns for them to pretend that they're going to be tough on issues like this. And it's domestic politics that's really in charge.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. All right, next on the program, we're going to talk about traveling. Now, there are many ways you can travel. Some people like to book package holidays, and you go with a big tour group, and you spend half your time on buses, going from one monument or museum to the other, stopping at shops along the way, and it could be rather boring. There are those who say, well, you know, I'm going to go to London today, and they just go. And then you have adventure holiday makers. This is more, I have to be honest, kind of more my style. Going to a country that most people would never think about going to, and not just going there for a week or 2 weeks, but deciding to live there. It tends to make it a lot more interesting. Well, there's a guy by the name of Matt Gibson, who is originally from Canada, from the west coast of Canada, in fact, who's an adventure writer. And he spent a fair amount of time here in Asia. He joins us next on the program to talk about this fascinating way to travel. Let me ask you, now, you've spent a number of years in Taiwan. First, I want to go back a little bit. How did you end up here?
When I came to Taiwan, it was a very random decision. I had just finished university and was struggling to pay student loans. So I took a job tree planting in Canada, which is a fairly well-known industry where you can make pretty good money for very hard work. And while I was tree planting, I met a fellow whose girlfriend was teaching in Taiwan. And we worked together for 3 days, And he decided to quit and go to Taiwan to teach English because he thought he could earn more money there. So he gave me his email address after 3 days and told me if I wanted to come, just to send him an email. And so about 6 months later, I did. And I hopped on a plane to Taiwan. I hardly even knew where it was on a map, and stayed with him for a month while I got myself set up with a job. And I ended up staying there for 6 years.
You know, it's quite interesting because Taiwan is one of those places where, I mean, I've heard this myself when people have asked me, like, where do you live? Where's your residence? And I say Taiwan, and they go, oh, isn't the capital Bangkok? And I say, wait a second, no, that's Thailand. Taiwan or the Republic of China is a different place.
Absolutely, yeah. When there was the tsunami in Thailand, my Facebook was flooded with people concerned about me. And I was like, no, I'm fine. I'm about 2,000 miles away.
So let me ask you then, you like to obviously travel. So were you using Taiwan as a base then for other areas in Asia?
Taiwan was very much my home after living there for 6 years, but it was an excellent jumping off point to go to other places in Asia, because once you're in Asia, there are a lot of budget airlines that will fly you places very cheaply. So we would sometimes get tickets to the Philippines round trip for about $40 or $50 US. So we visited the Philippines several times. It was very inexpensive to go to Thailand and to go to Cambodia or Laos or any place like that. So it was really just a great place to start from.
And how did you settle in here in Taiwan? I mean, I've been in Hong Kong and other places, even spent quite a few, bit of time in China. And personally, I always found the first time that I came here a very easy place to settle in. It wasn't much of a culture shock or anything for me.
Taiwan is a very easy place to live, especially as an English teacher, because, well, first, it's one of the most amazingly friendly countries that I've ever been in. And people, they're very, very welcoming to outsiders and go out of their way to try to make you feel welcome. And as an English teacher, you earn a salary that's almost on par with a doctor or a lawyer. So as a young person just out of university, if you show up, everyone treats you very well. You make way more money than you could have ever imagined being able to make. You can live a great lifestyle. So a lot of people do show up for 1 year and end up staying there for 10 or longer.
Now, let's talk about traveling for a moment. When did this interest in you in adventure travel start?
I started writing about travel. My ambition has always been, was always to be a writer. And I used my time teaching English in Taiwan to start to launch that. And I thought that since I was in Taiwan, it would be a good idea to focus on travel writing. And as a natural extension of that, I'm a very outdoorsy person. I really don't care for staying in five-star hotels. I don't care for eating at expensive restaurants. I do care about hiking and scuba diving and surfing and trying new sports outside. So the really natural thing for me to pursue was adventure travel, just because that is what I like to do.
But was there something, I mean, when you were growing up, that a trip that you went on that went, oh, you know, maybe I'd like to focus on this one day?
Oh, well, I grew up in a very small town in British Columbia. If you walked out of our backyard and kept going straight, you'd go about 80 miles before you crossed a paved road.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents growing up did not allow us to watch TV. When we came home, the first thing they said was, go outside. And they just would kick us out of the house to go play in the woods. And that was how I grew up. And in the winter, we skied every single weekend. So my youth and growing up was always spent outside, you know, running around, hiking, climbing, walking through rivers, swimming in lakes, that kind of thing. So it just, that carried through into my adult life. That's really how I like to spend my time.
So when you were living here in Asia, where were some of the places that you visited, and what were some of the most interesting or some of the strangest experiences that you had?
Oh, Asia is a strange place for a Westerner. I got to go to Borneo, which was amazing because the wildlife there is incredible. I was very fortunate to have Malaysia Borneo ask me to go shoot pygmy elephants, which are an incredibly hard animal to find because they roam about 50 miles a day. And I had an amazing guide who took me out looking for them there, and we were able to find them in a few days. That was a really incredible experience. In a very different way, in Taiwan once, I had a girlfriend who had a scooter accident in which her foot was hurt very badly. It was swollen up very, very large, about the size of a potato, and she was wearing a cast. We had walked out of a restaurant one evening, and the fellow who owned the liquor store next to the restaurant started calling out to us in Chinese, telling us, "Come here, come here, come here." So we went in, and my girlfriend didn't speak Chinese at the time, but I did. And he told me that he saw a ghost following her, because in Chinese culture, people believe very strongly in ghosts. And he said that he would help her to get rid of the ghost. And he did not want any money. He really sincerely just wanted to help her. So he sat her down on a stool in his liquor store and started to do all these sort of Tai Chi motions in front of her face. He was just waving his hands around and then started making these strange noises like waka, 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 ooga, ooga. Like, it was very strange and went on for about 30 minutes. And at the end, he told me that he had helped her, and he had helped to unblock her chi because her chi was blocked, and that he was not able to get rid of the ghost, but if she came back two more times before the end of ghost month, he could get rid of the ghost.
Right.
So we went home, and we were, like, laughing about it and, you know, just joking around about the noises he made and the funny stuff he did. But when we got home, we were watching TV, and she unwrapped her foot to rewrap it, and the swelling had disappeared so quickly that her skin had wrinkled like it was the oversized sock. And whatever he did had taken all of the swelling out of her foot. He never actually physically even touched her once. It was the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen, and it astounded us both.
You know, a number of years ago, there was something that happened at a restaurant that was located outside of Shanghai. I was in Shanghai for a bit, and I had some friends that were visiting Matt, and they were both vegetarian. And as you probably know, in parts of Asia, if you're vegetarian, it's very difficult to find a place to eat, especially if you're a strict vegetarian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we were at this restaurant. And I asked the waitress, I said, "Okay, I know you have tofu and you have this vegetable thing on the menu. Is there anything else that you have that is vegetarian?" And she looked at me with a straight face and said, "Chicken." And I said, "Excuse me?" And I said, "Yeah, but chicken is meat." "Yeah, but," she said, "chicken doesn't eat meat." And I said, let me, I'll re-ask the question again. And I re-asked her in Chinese. I said, "Do you have anything that is not meat-based and is not cooked with meat and is not meat?" And then she said, "Pork." And I said, "Excuse me?" And she said, "Yeah, but pigs and chickens don't eat meat." I said, no, you don't understand. Anyway, I just felt like I was in a comedy. And at that point, I said, "You know what? Let's just order the tofu. Yeah. And it'll be a lot easier." Now, there must be some people that ask you, "Matt, you know, I wanted to do some adventure traveling. What should I do? Should I prepare or should I just get on a plane and go somewhere?"
Well, you know, that's a very personal kind of question to ask. So it's a very hard thing to answer for anyone, because really what it comes down to is the kind of experience that a person is going to enjoy. And there are a lot of people who are not comfortable just jumping off into the unknown and, you know, going for it, which is my favorite way to travel. But I'm a very different type of person in the things I enjoy. I really enjoy getting myself into very uncomfortable and awful situations and then trying to get out of them. Mm-hmm. And that's not for everybody. I once rented a motorcycle in Borneo, when it was the dry season in Taiwan, and Borneo is only a few hundred kilometers south from Taiwan. So I assumed they had the same rainy season, and I was completely wrong. And I drove into a monsoon on a motorcycle in the middle of nowhere where I had to drive for 12 hours to get to a place. And I enjoy that in a really strange, very weird way. So I don't think that kind of travel is the best for everyone, but I always recommend to people that you should not plan everything you do.
But the thing is, Matt, you know, you get stuck in a rainstorm. I mean, myself, I would look at that as being, I would laugh at the situation myself. I mean, what do you do about it, you know?
Well, when you get to something that's that ridiculous, I'd never seen rain like that. It was one of those days where the stilt houses?
Right.
The water was up to the floor of the stilt houses on the sides of the road, which was raised. It was very, very extreme. But there is something really comedic about it. When you do that, you can only laugh at it because you have no other choice. Because you can't just stop. That's impossible. It's not an option. And I enjoy those situations where you make yourself sink or swim, and so that you can see that you will swim and you will eventually get yourself out of it. And I also just enjoy, I never read a guidebook before I go somewhere. I like to just show up and learn for myself the hard way. And that way the things that you do find are more special because you found them on your own, rather than being shown them by somebody else.
Well, it also makes it more interesting. I mean, one of my biggest criticism, I think, of most guidebooks that I have flipped through is that either they come out years in advance or the information is old. And then by the time you get there, you're like, wait a second. It says there's a building here, a building you want to see. But it's a park now, or there was a park here, or this is gone, or whatever. But I mean, let me ask you, I mean, you did spend, 6 years here in Asia. There must be places that you'd gone to. I mean, one place that I have been to a few times over the last 8 years, and most recently I found that the place has changed dramatically, is Burma. Other people call it Myanmar. There were tremendous changes there, and especially since the changes started to take place, it's almost like going to a country now that is becoming part of, I wouldn't say modernizing, but it is becoming what it really should be. I mean, for years it was just as oppressive as some other countries, so it's really, really changing. There must be places that you'd want to go to, or maybe you've been to, and there were some changes that you'd like to go back to see how things are.
Well, there are definitely places I wish had never changed, that's for sure. As like southern Taiwan, I do miss what it was when I first lived there. And because in a way it felt like it belonged to us, because at that time there were very, very few Caucasian people there. You would not see another Caucasian person in the street ever in southern Taiwan unless you went to a restaurant or bar that you knew where they were. And now it has become a much more popular place for people to move to go study as well as to work. And it's so many more people now that I really wish I could have frozen it in time the way it was when I first went. There are some places, though, that I would also love to see become more popular and more developed because they really deserve it. And Taiwan as a tourist destination deserves so much more attention than it gets. It is a beautiful subtropical island with beaches on par with the rest of Southeast Asia, with mountains that are incredibly tall and just majestic, and a culture that is rich and a heritage that's so deep that it really deserves to be explored and seen. So in that way, I would kind of like to see Taiwan change that way. I'd love to also see more people, visiting Malaysian Borneo, where the conservation efforts are funded by tourism 100%, and they really do need the conservation there. I would like to see a lot less 18-year-olds in Thailand and Laos. I feel like Laos as a country is such a gem of a country and such a sort of an innocent country that has had little exposure to other cultures and has developed its own very, very, you know, a very unique, very warm culture. And all of those, you know, the gap year backpackers, I understand what they want to do, and I don't want to say that that's a bad way to travel, but having them be Laos' first influence from the West seems like very wrong, because they're just showing up, you know, getting drunk, you know, jumping into rivers off of rope swings and having big parties, and it seems, it that really doesn't seem right.
Matt Gibson, travel writer, or rather I should say adventure travel writer. If you want to read his blog, the URL is www.matt-gibson.org. That's matt-gibson.org. If you didn't have time to write that down, don't worry, you can contact us and we will forward that to you. Anyway, with that, we have come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us and let us know what you think of the program, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Until next time, so long, take care, and have a great weekend.